From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Happy holidays. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is the Sunday Spin, our weekly look at the politics and policies that affect you coming out of Washington, Springfield, and City Hall. Thanks for tuning us in this morning. Grab a cup of coffee, the Sunday paper, and we'll try to get your holiday week off to a great start. Maybe get you kind of up and at 'em as you try to finalize some of that last-minute shopping. Well, okay, so last week I said I hadn't been feeling the Christmas spirit yet, but on Friday I finally got it going. WGN Radio performed a live broadcast of the radio version of It's a Wonderful Life. And I have to tell you, I went back and listened to it, because when you're doing it, you don't really appreciate it. I went back and listened to it, and it was really pretty good. You had Steve Cochran was Clarence the Angel, Bill Leff was George Bailey. And apparently, Dave, I was typecast as the absent-minded Uncle Billy. So,
did you? Well, since it was radio, you really couldn't see. But did you, in the spirit of the play, tie strings around your fingers like Uncle Billy did?
I thought about that, but given the absent-mindedness, I just thought I forgot
about it.
I forget. Yes. And then I forgot my lines, too.
And then you forgot your lines with a script in front of you, no less.
No less. But it actually was very funny. And you know, so many of the people here doing the production. And there's this great part where Bill Leff, you know, the movie, if you remember the movie, because you've only seen it how many millions of times.
Lost count.
But, it's Bedford Falls is where the Bailey Building and Loan is, but Bill Leff did this takeoff of Bedford Park, and literally he and Wendy, who was playing, I think, Ma Bailey.
Oh, she played Ma Bailey.
They went back and forth and did the entire Bedford Park commercial just off the top of their heads. So,
who played Mary? Who played George's wife?
Well, that was Marianne.
Ah, okay.
And you had Pete McMurray was Harry Bailey.
Okay.
And it was kind of an interesting take on this play because, as I said, there's all these characters. And, of course, you had a couple of people that only had a couple of lines and then failed to show up. So there was, you had some emergency part playing going on. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And you did not mention who played Mr. Potter.
Bob Surratt.
Bob Surratt was
Mr. Potter, yes.
Bob Surratt.
He did very well. And of course, the scene where, Uncle Billy hands Mr. Potter the paper with the $8,000
in it. You just can't keep those Bailey boys down.
No. And so I think the line from Mr. Potter is, "Let me see that paper." And I said, "Sure, you can have my copy of the Tribune." So,
Mary, wouldn't you have loved to have been a part of this?
Yes, actually, I was listening to it.
Were you?
Mm-hmm.
So how did it sound, Mary?
I think it sounded great. I'm hoping that I think you guys are going to replay it again, aren't we, on Christmas Eve?
I think it's supposed to be replayed either Christmas Eve or
Christmas
Day.
Morning, yeah.
But you can hear it on WGNradio.com. And the really star of the show, though, was Zuzu. Because it was the real Zuzu. Carolyn Grimes, the original movie Zuzu, she was in the area doing a promotion, I think, in St. Charles for a theater that's showing It's a Wonderful Life. And she reprised her part. And I got to tell you, if getting to meet the real Zuzu doesn't get you in the holiday spirit,
nothing will.
Nothing will. And when she did the part on the radio show, she had the child's voice, and I'm not going to give Carolyn Grimes' age, but she sounded just like the movie.
She did in the movie, yeah.
It was fantastic. So, I mean, as I said, you can find it at WGNRadio.com. And, yes, I believe it's going to get re-aired. I just don't have the details on that yet.
You know, the movie came out in 1946. So in 2016, if my math is correct, well, that'll make it 70 years?
That's probably
old?
About, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that would be about right.
Man, oh, man.
Yeah.
My favorite Christmas show.
Yeah.
Yep, sure is.
Well, and of course, now what? They only show it once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
Where I know.
I think NBC bought the rights to it, and they show it the weekend after Thanksgiving or the first weekend in December. It was on this year, first of the month.
So it's already been on.
Oh, yeah. It's already been on.
They don't play it enough. They do not play it enough.
No, I mean, I think, you know, given the proliferation of cable channels, you could have just one channel dedicated to keep playing It's a Wonderful Life. Kind of like how,
play a Christmas Story.
Well, isn't that what Turner?
Turner, TNT used to. I don't know if they're going to do it again this year, but that's right. And then the Sci-Fi Channel on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day is a Twilight Zone marathon.
Yeah, and that's great, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, for some people waking up after on New Year's Day, that is like a Twilight Zone for them.
How apropos.
They should keep showing the one where the sun never comes up. And the guy gets freaked out when it's 9 o'clock in the morning and it's not daylight yet.
Yes, I think we've all been on that Twilight Zone episode now and then. Wow. Yeah. But it was as I said, it was just a lot of fun, and everybody had a great time, and it was like an old radio play, you know. You had the organ music and all that kind of stuff, and just a great time, and I can't say enough. And thanks to everybody here for letting me play a small part in it. I did ad lib one other line, and that was the scene where the bank there was the run on the Bailey Brothers building and loan, and the bank run, and I have to tell George that, you know, the bank has called in our loan, and I have to turn over all the money. I said, it's kind of like the last time the Illinois legislature visited over here, which I thought it worked. I thought it was a good line.
Yeah.
But Dave's in the newsroom. Mary's got her eye on the traffic. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls and texts. 312-981-7200 is our phone number, also our text line. And engineer Bob Ferguson is tilling the rudder here to keep the mighty 720 afloat this morning. Coming up, my Tribune colleague David Kidwell joins the show to talk about his latest on Chicago's red light cameras and how City Hall's talk of improved safety doesn't really measure up. That'll be after Dave brings us the 7:30 news. After the 8 o'clock news, DePaul Law Professor Alberto Cole joins me by phone from Miami. Professor Cole just finished a week in Havana, and we'll talk about President Obama's call for normalizing relations with Cuba. Then, after the 8:30 news, State Senator Kwame Raoul, a Chicago Democrat, he'll be joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio to talk about a proposed law, a bill that's already passed the legislature to rewrite the eavesdropping statute, which was ruled unconstitutional by the Illinois Supreme Court. It's getting a bad rap in social media, and Senator Kwame Raoul, who replaced Senator Obama, actually, Senator Raoul will be here to try and tell us how the law really works against some of the criticism that's come up in social media. Senator Raoul also is the sponsor of a proposed state constitutional amendment that would merge the offices of comptroller and treasurer into one office. And, of course, there's a lot of renewed talk about that in the aftermath of the death of comptroller Judy Bart Topinka. So we'll talk about that, too. That's all coming up, but first it's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and first up is President Obama calling it a mistake for Sony Pictures to pull the movie The Interview after a hacking scandal and threats that have been attributed by the U.S. to the North Korean government, something that the North Koreans deny. Well, here's the president.
We cannot have a society in which some dictator someplace can start imposing censorship here in the United States. Because if somebody is able to intimidate folks out of releasing a satirical movie. Imagine what they start doing when they see a documentary that they don't like or news reports that they don't like. Or even worse, imagine if producers and distributors and others start engaging in self-censorship because they don't want to offend the sensibilities of somebody whose sensibilities probably need to be offended. That's not who we are. That's not what America's about. I'm sympathetic that Sony, as a private company, was worried about liabilities and this and that and the other. I wish they had spoken to me first. I would have told them, do not get into a pattern in which you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks.
Now, of course, the other big news from the White House last week was the president's decision to move toward normalizing relations with Cuba after sanctions first imposed more than 50 years ago.
Given Cuba's history, I expect it will continue to pursue foreign policies that will at times be sharply at odds with American interests. I do not expect the changes I'm announcing today to bring about a transformation of Cuban society overnight, but I am convinced that through a policy of engagement, we can more effectively stand up for our values and help the Cuban people help themselves as they move into the 21st century.
Now, the president's move prompted outrage from some lawmakers, including Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. Rubio is considering a possible bid for the White House in 2016.
It is a victory for the oppressive Cuban government, but a serious setback for the repressed Cuban people. The White House has conceded everything and gained little. They gained no commitment on the part of the Cuban regime to freedom of press or freedom of speech or elections. No binding commitment was made to truly open up the internet. No commitment was made to allowing the establishment of political parties or to even begin the semblance of a transition to democracy.
Rubio's view wasn't shared by all senators or all Republicans. Now, here's Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. He played a role in the Cuban government's release of American contractor Alan Gross.
We really haven't had a kind of a test vote on Cuba for a while. We used to regularly have votes on appropriation bills to lift the travel ban or deny funding for lifting the travel ban. Or imposing the travel ban, I'm sorry. But we haven't had one of those for a while, and there have been a lot of new senators come in. So we'll see. My sense is that that most of my colleagues feel we're long past due. 50 years. And so I think that the politics are good. Certainly the policy is right, and good politics usually follow.
Well, and that's Senator Jeff Flake's view. I'm not so sure that everybody is as optimistic as he is about the Congress moving forward as quickly as he would like. Now, of course, we talked about Marco Rubio, and he's getting renewed attention as he considers a 2016 presidential bid. I think Rubio's on three of the talk shows, the Sunday morning talk shows this morning. But there's another Florida politician who's taking steps toward a White House run. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush released thousands of emails and records from his tenure as governor. And he told followers on social media he was actively considering a bid. Right before he made that kind of declaration in social media, he spoke to a Florida TV station about what were kind of his considerations as he was deliberating about whether to actively explore a bid for president. Here's Jeb Bush.
It's really personal. It's really personal. Do I have what it takes to go through a campaign and be capable of leading this country? That's a humbling thought if you're really serious about it. And secondly, is it the right thing for my family? Can they accept the sacrifice that is forthcoming in this kind of deal? So that's the focus. The rest of it kind of falls into place after that. I have no clue if I would be a good candidate. I hope I would be. I think I could serve well as president, to be honest with you, but I don't know that either. I think you learn these things as you go along. But the things that most matter are really personal.
That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush could have the possibility of a Bush-Clinton matchup for 2016. Very interesting. Finally, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, Republican Congresswoman, is leaving Congress after 8 years. She, of course, made a unsuccessful bid for the Republican nomination for president last time around, actually won the Iowa straw poll in Ames before falling way short in the Iowa caucuses and dropping out shortly after. But CNN's Dana Bash took a look at Michelle Bachmann, a popular Tea Party-backed congresswoman, about her tenure. And Michelle Bachmann joked about the fact that she might become a rapper.
I look incredible. I'll wear your granddad's clothes. I got $20 in my pocket, and I'm going to the thrift shop down the road.
Anybody got a beatbox?
I got $20 in my pocket.
That's Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about brotherly love from mom. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
The snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all
the way. That's the University of Illinois Ripcords a cappella choir doing our Christmas music again, holiday music again for this Sunday, thanks to them. C-SPAN is kind of I kind of view that as almost like electronic wallpaper sometimes. And you know, you get some interesting kind of discussions that go on. And last week, a very interesting one. Brad Woodhouse is a longtime Democratic consultant, spokesman. And I didn't realize that his brother, Dallas Woodhouse, is a Republican pundit. And so Brad and Dallas Woodhouse were on C-SPAN with host Steve Scully to kind of talk and debate right versus left, Republican versus Democrat. And during the show, there was an interesting caller. Steve Scully begins the conversation.
Let's go to Joy. Go to Joy in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning.
Hey, somebody from down south.
Well, you're right, I'm from down south.
Oh, God, it's mom.
And I'm your mother. And I disagree that all families are like ours. I don't know many families that are fighting at Thanksgiving.
Is this really your mother?
No, it's my mom.
I was very glad that this Thanksgiving was a year that you two were supposed to go to your in-laws. And I'm hoping you'll have some of this out of your system when you come here for Christmas.
Yeah, we were really not together this Thanksgiving. We are most years.
I would really like a peaceful Christmas, and I love you both.
Hey, now let me jump in, because this was not planned. She called in on the normal line, so but since you did call in, Mrs. Woodhouse, what's it like to raise these two boys?
Well, it hadn't been easy.
No true words have ever been said.
Oh, God.
Well, we love you, Mom.
And I love politics. Their dad and I both love politics. We follow the entire country. I know that we have to take responsibility for them. And they're both very passionate about what they believe in. And I love that about them. But I hope that they just kind of get this out of their system today on your program.
Boy, can you imagine going to Christmas at the Woodhouses? That's from C-SPAN. The brotherly love as only mom could display it. You're listening to the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
312-981-7200 is our phone number on the Sunday morning Sunday Spin, 7:36 in the morning. Hope you got your cup of coffee, your Sunday paper, maybe some breakfast going on in the background. We've got breakfast here. Jasmine, what have we got here?
Our breakfast this week was brought to you by West Egg Cafe, which is located at 621 North Fairbanks Court in Chicago. Their hours are Monday through Friday from 6:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. So they also brought us Best Western, excuse me, which is a great breakfast dish. They also brought us some Mexican food, breakfast burrito, Albuquerque turkey benedict. Pancakes.
Apparently Steve Dale likes the free food.
Yes, Steve Dale likes the free food. And they also brought us orange juice.
Yay. Albuquerque turkey?
Albuquerque turkey benedict.
Wow. That sounds intriguing. Well, I'm glad you guys are all enjoying it there in the production booth while I get to watch you all enjoy it. And yes, now Dave Schwann has just heard the pitch, so now he's obviously ambling over there instead of today was the day he was supposed to wash out the newsroom hot tub. Apparently he's given that up to go ahead and eat. But yes, we want to thank the folks from the West Egg Cafe. Where are they located again?
620 North Fairbanks Court.
All right. Well, thank you. I can't wait to try it. Maybe while Schwann is actually doing some work with the newscast, I might sneak in and get a taste of this. So thanks again very much, West Egg Cafe. Joining me now in the Allstate Showcase studio is my Tribune colleague and great investigative reporter, David Kidwell. And when I said grab the Sunday paper, I really mean grab the Sunday paper, because you'll see on the front page David's latest work involving the saga of Chicago and the sordid history of red light cameras. Was that a fair way to say it?
Yeah, I guess it probably would be. this story's been going on for more than 2 years now.
But it kind of perpetuates itself in many respects. And well, let's talk about what this latest story is. And this is basically the results of a study conducted about the efficacy of red light cameras, as well as kind of comparing what the City Hall Emanuel administration vows were and their kind of findings compared to what's really going on.
Sure. So how this started was, as you know, this program has been under the gun, so to speak, beleaguered for several years. And their fallback position has always been, yes, but it keeps us safer. Yes, it's corrupt, but it keeps us safer. Yes,
about the money.
We had some spikes that we can't explain, but it keeps us safer. It's safer. So the Tribune, much to its credit, decided, you know, to spend some money and go out and figure out whether indeed it does keep us safer. And so my editors agreed to go out and commission some actual scientists. Me and another reporter, Alex Richards, who is our data specialist at the Tribune, spent months gathering the data for this study, we turned all this data over gathered it with advice from all these experts and turned this data over to some scientists, some traffic safety scientists, and they crunched those numbers, and finally we recently got the results of that, and what we found out was, even though the city had been claiming for a while that the red light cameras, the intersections where red light cameras were down, you know, that right angle crashes were down 47%. The fact of the matter is they're not. They're down 15%. But what the city doesn't say also is that there's a corresponding increase in rear end crashes. And in the aggregate, the number of injury crashes went up because of red light cameras in the city of Chicago.
So and this data went to what, Texas A&M? You had actually academic researchers crunching.
Oh yes. And I'm not going to bore you with all the science of it. There's a lot of Greek language in the formula,
yes.
and you know, think terms like regression to the mean and control groups and. It was a pretty deep dive into this thing, and in fact, you know, when we showed it to the city, they had a number of questions, but after we answered them, the city acknowledged that yes, this is the kind of study that should be used to judge this kind of thing, and no, we have never done it before.
And I found that kind of astounding too, because you would think number one, how can you go and say, as the city claimed, that you know, the right turn, what is it, T-bone?
Yeah, that
kind of thing. How can they say that it's down and then they hadn't done a study?
Well, it's very interesting that it took the Tribune. I mean, this thing's 12 years old now. It's raised more than $500 million. That's a billion with a B. And they apparently have not spent one thin dime of that trying to figure out the effectiveness of this program. They've used very what our scientists would call naive science. They compare just raw crashes from one year to raw crashes from another year to do this. And that's the number that they use. And they've never endeavored to look at take a scientific look at how these things operate.
Yes, because we don't have any kind of academic research institutions in the city of Chicago, apparently, to be able to conduct this.
Right. Well, this there's been a pattern of false statements coming out of City Hall in regards to their camera operations almost from the beginning. There's a little bit of sidebar in today's story about sort of some of those, illustrating some of those.
Well, it's a history of misspeaking of this is I'm trying to put it in the best light, okay? I misspoke, or I got the wrong report, or this was just a draft report, or you know how many times can you hear this and just say what is going on here?
Well, this is somewhat of a sacred cow, and that's sort of how we got onto this in the first place. This program had been held up as a model in the country. It's the largest red light camera program in the country, perhaps the world. We haven't spent a lot of time around the world looking for larger ones. We can't find one. We don't know of one. And when Rahm Emanuel took office, he used the record of the red light camera, which at that point was stellar, according right. to, by all accounts, to sell his new speed camera initiative. And that's sort of how we got onto this. They were making claims, and we asked Rahm Emanuel about some of those things. And one of the first things that we came across that turned out not to be true was his claim that fatalities at red light cameras were down 60% because of the red light mm-hmm. cameras. I got a study. You know, you guys are ignoring the study. You got to look at the study. And it turned out the study really wasn't a study, and then all the numbers in it were wrong. And that after we took a look at it, the city had to acknowledge they were all wrong. And in fact, the cameras weren't really responsible for a reduction in pedestrian fatalities. And that sort of just kicked off this, well, okay, if that's
if
not
that's
true,
not
what's,
true right.
what else isn't true?
Exactly.
And we kept going, and we came across the corruption where there's now been federal indictments against the former city hall manager who was in charge of bringing red light cameras to the city back in 2002 and oversaw the program for 10 years before his retirement. His name was John Bills, a longtime Madigan patronage worker for House Speaker Mike Madigan. And he was the deputy managing commissioner or deputy managing director of in the city department of transportation at the time, and in charge of the red light camera program. It turns out, according to federal prosecutors, he was taking up to $2 million in bribes for the company that the vendor, Redflex Traffic Systems, who was the first vendor. And when we started writing those stories, the mayor. Ended up having to fire them, and they're now gone. But there's a new company here, and over the summer we decided, you know what, if there's so much corruption behind how these things got installed, and maybe where they went, and there's really not much of a record left anymore about how they installed these things or where they installed, why they installed them where they were.
Right.
Let's take a look at the program itself. So then we got fought the city for and got a database of all the tickets.
Right.
Over the summer, you'll remember we did
that was
a
the story about the odd spikes that haven't been explained.
They still can't explain them. So we found these instances all over the city where cameras that were issuing two and three tickets a day were suddenly going up to 50 tickets a day for periods of time.
And enforcing different things.
Yes.
Where they were more looking, some of them more looking at right turn on red, then they changed to yellow, you know, the short yellow.
Well, we have found cameras that were they didn't issue right turns on red for forever, and then all of a sudden, for a period of time, that's all they were doing.
Right.
And then they'd go back.
Which ran counter to what these are supposed to be, kind of somewhat a teaching tool in some respects as well. But I want to get back to more of this because there's more findings in this study that I found very interesting. David Kidwell from the Chicago Tribune is joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin on WGN.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care about the presents underneath the Christmas tree. I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. Make my wish come true.
The University of Illinois Ripcords providing our holiday music this morning. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin, and joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio again is David Kidwell, the author of the front page story in today's Sunday Tribune with the latest in the saga of Chicago and its red light cameras. And this is a really deep dive of data that you did. Again, the claimed reductions by the city of right angle crashes, not 47% as the city said, 15%. And at the same time, and this is what I really wanted to ask about, the study calculated a corresponding 22% increase in rear end crashes that caused injuries. How much of that, and maybe we don't know, is a result of them playing with the timing of the yellow light?
Right.
And shortening that interval till it goes red.
Right. Well, this is the first day of a three-part series.
Okay.
There is going to be
I'm sorry. Am I giving away? I don't want to give anything away here.
The last day of the series is going to get into our city's yellow light times that are low. They're too low based on national standards set by the national group that's supposed to be doing that. They're too low by the standards of every other city that we've surveyed. And we've surveyed almost all of them.
Right.
So the combination of the yellow light being 3 seconds in a 30-mile-an-hour speed zone, along with the red light cameras, many of them in places where they really shouldn't be, those two things together is a dangerous combination.
Well, and you just talked about the cameras where they shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that means?
That's day two.
Okay.
So in Monday's paper, we mentioned it a little bit in today's newspaper, but in Monday's paper, we're going to give people a list of 73 intersections in the city where these cameras had no benefit whatsoever. There was no reduction. Forget 15%. Mm-hmm. There was no reduction at all in right-angle injury crashes, and there was an increase in rear enders. So there's a huge potential.
So a negative impact.
That these things made things worse at up to 75 intersections, which is 40% of the program in the city of Chicago, and the reason we were able to provide that list is because our researchers or the scientists said that these things had no benefit in the city of Chicago at any intersection where they were installed, where before they were installed, the number of injury crashes averaged less than 4 per year. So the city put up red light cameras where there wasn't a problem.
Right.
To begin with. And so we're going to list all of those intersections. So which brings the next question is, well, why? What what was the city thinking at the time? And that gets us back to the idea that the guy who was in charge of installing these cameras has now been charged in a cameras for cash bribery scheme. So it just calls into question everything about this program since it began.
The very nature of the program.
Correct.
Because it's built on faulty assumptions.
Well, that's
and so far faulty explanations.
Correct. And it's been defended with many, many misstatements through two administrations.
All right. Well, so we've got today's story, we've got one coming Monday, another one on Tuesday. Is that that's the series?
That's the plan.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Very good. David Kidwell, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, thank you so much. Thanks for all of the work on this. And it's just fascinating stuff. And everybody needs to get a copy of the Tribune and take a look at this if you're driving in the city. And
don't look at it while you're driving.
That would be a good idea. That would be, yes. But buy several copies of the paper.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Appreciate it. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I didn't really want to talk about the Blackhawks in the opening like I normally do. And I have to tell you, I actually went to sleep before the game was over. And I think the shootout, and you all know what I think of hockey shootouts, but I think it went like 9 or 10 rounds. And then the Hawks ended up on the short end. So still, they pick up a point, and we'll have the Blackhawks back home against Toronto tonight. And that game you can hear right here at 6 o'clock. Pregame with Judd is at 5:30. So obviously, perfect reason. Just leave your radio on to WGN all day. No sense listening to the Bears game. I mean, come on. We know about that. So let's go Blackhawks. Our next guest is Dr. Alberto Cole, who's a professor of law at DePaul University and perhaps one of the most foremost knowledgeable people about the issues involving Cuba and Latin America and U.S. relations. And Professor Cole, before joining DePaul, served for 5 years as dean of the Center of Naval Warfare Studies, the U.S. Navy's foremost strategic research center. And Professor Cole joins us from Miami after having spent the previous week in Havana. Professor, thank you very much for joining me today on the Sunday Spin.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be with you. And I literally just returned from Havana. I'm in Miami now. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that had to be a very interesting time to be in Havana as you have President Obama talking about trying to reestablish normalizing relations with Cuba after 50 years of sanctions against the country.
It was wonderful. I cannot tell you how exciting it was. I was down in Havana for a major conference involving U.S. Academics and former U.S. senior policymakers with Cuban academics and Cuban officials. And we were discussing the whole subject of the conference was how to improve U.S.-Cuba relations. And you have no idea of how exciting this was on Wednesday morning when the news started coming in. And both President Obama and President Raul Castro made their speeches. We were there. And everyone was ecstatic.
I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done. I mean, the embargo isn't lifted. It's also part of a long political process here in the U.S. I had played a clip from Senator Jeff Flake, Arizona Republican, who expressed a great deal of optimism that the new Republican majorities, the new Republican majority in the Senate, along with the existing Republican majority in the House, that ultimately they would be supportive of lifting the embargo and normalizing relations. I'm not so sure that the political will exists at this point, but certainly the president's steps can help move that process along.
Absolutely. Two things to keep in mind. First of all, the president, under his own authority under the Constitution's Article 2, which gives the president almost exclusive authority over foreign policy, has wide latitude in moving forward the normalization of relations with Cuba. In fact, he has complete authority on the issue of establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba. He does not need Congress to do that. And in the issue of the embargo, even though the embargo itself is created by law, by a congressional law, the law specifies for the president a great deal of licensing authority. In other words, the law itself gives the president the authority under his licensing power to relax or tighten the embargo as he sees fit, so that even within the framework of the embargo, which again only Congress can do away with, the president could relax a great deal of restrictions on Cuba through his executive authority, and that is part of the law. And to take away that authority from the president, the Congress would have to revise the law, in other words, pass a new law or an amendment, which the president, of course, could veto if he chose to. So under the current framework, the president can relax the embargo a great deal, and that's what he intends to do. Now, as you mentioned, Senator Flake, who's been a great friend of better U.S.-Cuba relations, Senator Rand Paul has already stepped up to the plate and applauded the president on his initiative. There's a hardcore of Republicans that are still lining up with the very small minority that supports a hardline policy towards Cuba. But my hope is that over the next couple of years, as the tempo of U.S.-Cuba relations increases, that the U.S. business lobby will step in, as it started to do, and push the Republican Party to realize the tremendous benefits of a better relationship with Cuba. And indeed, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is a very strong ally of the Republican Party, has come out on the record supporting closer relations with Cuba. And the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Tom Donahue, was here in Havana about half a year ago, in fact, to promote better relations between both countries. And he was very critical of the embargo. So that's my hope, that over the next 2 years, we can create enough momentum to relax relations between both countries and make it very difficult 2 years from now to undo this.
Well, Professor, I mean, and of course, we're moving into a presidential election year. You've got Marco Rubio very critical of the president's move here. And of course, he's looking at a potential bid for the 2016 Republican nomination. But you also cited the fact that this, you know, there is that minority, and it does seem to be more of a minority thought now than playing to a bigger stage when it comes to the hardliners that oppose the normalization of relationships with Cuba. It's not that predominant thought that existed particularly in South Florida as it once did.
Right. In fact, in South Florida itself, opinion is very heavily divided. And among Cuban Americans, at least half of them support the president's measures. So there's no longer a clear political gain for a politician to come out in favor of the embargo as there was 10, 15, 20 years ago. The generations are changing. Opinions are changing. The failed policy of the last 52 years, too, carries a great deal of weight with people, as the president said. Why would you keep doing over and over again something that has failed to have any results for half a century? Now, again, you have to look at the political dynamics, and Hillary Clinton already has come out in favor of relaxing the policy towards Cuba, in favor of taking down the embargo. Jeb Bush, on the other hand, who has very close political ties with the Cuban hardliners, has so far come out in favor not only of keeping the embargo, but of tightening it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, will he be saying this 2 years from now, assuming he gets the nomination, he's in the general campaign, will he be saying this in spite of the opposition of the U.S. business lobby? We'll have to see.
Yes, and very interesting dynamic shaping up here. Professor Alberto Cole is joining me here on the Sunday Spin. We're going to take a quick break. This is WGN.
Hanukkah, Hanukkah, Hanukkah,
The University of Illinois Ripcord's providing us with our holiday music again this Sunday morning. This is the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, and on the phone is Professor Alberto Cole from DePaul University, one of the nation's foremost experts on U.S.-Cuban relations. Professor, what does it mean for Cuba to have the U.S. normalize relations?
It means a lot of things, all of them tremendously important. First of all, Cuba is now going to be treated as an equal. In other words, the United States government has said, even though we don't agree on a number of things, we're going to treat you as an equal. We're going to treat you the way we treat China, the way we treat Saudi Arabia, the way we treat Vietnam. These are countries that have dictatorships indeed that don't have a full democratic human rights record. But nevertheless, we're going to treat you as an equal, and we're going to have high-level relations so that we can discuss all our differences, not through a minor low-level diplomat and not under the cover of these so-called interest sections. But we're going to have a full embassy, full representation, and we're going to make a very big push to have the full spectrum of not just political but also commercial and economic relations with you. To Cuba, that means that the United States, which remember, for over 200 years, we have had these very close ties between Cuba and the United States. The Cuban War of Independence enjoyed the support of many Americans who went to Cuba as volunteers. As far back as the American Revolution, there were fundraising activities in Havana in favor of the American patriots. And then there are, of course, you know, the ties of culture, of jazz, of baseball, of boxing, and tremendously close trade ties. The United States has 300 million people. They are Cuba's natural market. And Cuba hopes that this market will open up and that American investment, American know-how, and Americans will become fully engaged with this small island of 11 million people and enable Cuba to move forward into this new world of the 21st century, to new levels of prosperity, of openness, and to the kind of relationship that, should be normal between two countries that are only separated 90 miles from each other.
Now, Professor, I went down to Cuba in October of 1999 when then-Governor George Ryan made his visit there. And I have to tell you, I see a country of so much promise, but with a people who are repressed. And how much of the benefits of a normalized relationship and the economic benefits to Cuba translate down to the everyday person in Cuba?
Well, this is what's different, Rick, and I, I was there in 99 also, visiting when you were there.
Right.
That visit very, very well. That was 15 years ago. Major things have been happening in Cuba since that time. As you know, Fidel Castro has left power. He's increasingly frail, hardly appears in public anymore. The government is now headed by his brother, Raul. And Raul has undertaken a series of fairly significant changes over the last 5 years. Cubans today, for example, are allowed, as they were not in 1999, they're allowed to buy and sell homes, they're allowed to have cell phones, and they're allowed to engage in a wide range of small private business activities. The Cuban agricultural sector has been liberalized considerably. These are the beginnings of an opening towards what we might call a Vietnamese style or even a Chinese style model. The Cuban government obviously is hoping to liberalize the economy, to attract foreign investment, and to tap on the energies of this nascent private sector. Following that, it is anybody's guess whether there will be a political opening. I am sure that many high-level officials in the Cuban government would like to have the Chinese model in the sense of maintaining political control over society while allowing a great deal of economic freedom. Whether they can pull that off or not, no one knows. But certainly many people in Cuba right now, they're optimistic that with the Cuban government's willingness to undertake these changes in the economy, that the U.S. opening will fit in very well with that and provide the opportunities to start growing Cuba's economy and to start developing this economy in a way that will bring real prosperity to lots of people. And then the political changes, that's another level that will be, I think, much more difficult to achieve. But at the same time, it will only help, I think, to have greater economic prosperity, to have more Cubans involved in economic activity if, you know, you have this new U.S. policy. And that could translate into greater calls for a more open political system. You know, the Cuban model, the model that the Cubans are trying to have, it may not be that far from what Mexico pulled off for many decades until about 20 years ago. We forget that Mexico had a one-party system for many decades. It was the institutionalized Revolutionary Party, which ruled Mexico for 71 years, even in the midst of considerable economic freedom. I think some Cuban officials today are looking at that model in which they say, you know, maybe we can maintain a political system in which we run the show, but at the same time allow a great deal of economic opening. And there are many people in Cuba also betting that that will not work, that as the economy prospers in the future, that the political controls will gradually crumble and relax, leading to a more open Cuban society.
But that kind of model of that government control collapsing doesn't appear imminent.
It's not going to collapse. No, that's a different. We should not be talking. In fact, President Obama said it is not in the interest of the United States to have Cuba or even the Cuban government collapse, because that would lead to chaos. That would lead to drug cartels and criminal elements moving to Cuba. We don't want that. But it could certainly lead to, not to collapse, but it could lead to relaxation. You know?
And more democratization.
Exactly. A gradual, slow loosening up of society to the degree that civil society gradually becomes more vigorous, to the degree that independent, economically funded pieces of society, what we call civil society, take root organically, not funded by the U.S. government, but organically as a result of this process, and in interactions with the U.S. private sector, these political controls will gradually loosen up. And that's, I think, perhaps the best hope for Cuba, not so much a collapse, which I think would be very problematical, but a gradual change in the direction of greater openness.
And
that, you know, we'll have to make a bet over the next 5 years whether that's the direction the country's going to take.
And so we've talked about the benefits for Cuba. What about what? How does the U.S. Win in this kind of a relationship?
Okay, a number of big wins. First of all, there's the Summit of the Americas coming up in April of 2015. All the Latin American countries, plus Canada and the United States, are going to gather. Latin American countries have been pressuring the United States to do this for a very long time. We in the United States have no idea of how offensive and how problematical American policy towards Cuba is for our neighbors. Our neighbors see our policy towards Cuba as illustrative of the kind of hegemony imperialist policies that we have followed, that we followed throughout the region for a very long time until very recently. So Cuba is a very important symbol for Latin America, and I think we Americans don't realize that, but that's the case. And so the United States saying we're going to normalize diplomatic relations with Cuba, it's close to the equivalent of the goodwill that the United States earned when Jimmy Carter agreed to return the Panama Canal to Panama. It was a big step, and it was seen as Latin America as a gesture on the part of the United States that we were willing to treat our Latin neighbors with respect and on the same level as we treat many other countries around the world. Secondly, for the United States. We look at Cuba today as a country with which we share many common interests. For example, at this conference where I was tremendously impressed by the work that Cuban and American scientists have been doing in the areas of the environment, in the areas of fisheries. You know, we share a common water boundaries. We share a common ecosystem right in the heart of the Caribbean. Our cooperation in the area of counter-drugs, in the area of counter-terrorism. It is in the interest of the United States to be deeply engaged in Cuba, not isolated from Cuba, as has been the case with the embargo, but deeply engaged with Cuba. We don't want Cuba in the future to become a focus for the export of illegal drugs to the United States. We don't want Cuba to become a major center for money laundering, or for the trafficking of persons or even of terrorists to the United States. So this step means that we will be able to be much more closely involved with a small neighbor that is so close to us that it is strategically important to us to be there, to be engaged with them. So that is a second benefit.
Professor Cole, our time is very short, so I have to take a break, but I want to thank you very much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin. I appreciate your insights, and we'll be having you back again to talk about this when you get back to Chicago sometime soon. Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful morning. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good holiday Sunday morning. Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, where we have our breakfast from the West Egg Cafe. And the West Egg Cafe is located at 620 North Fairbanks Court. And Jasmine, I'm Schwani's back for seconds, I see. I haven't, thirds. He says thirds.
Rick, can I just say something?
Yes.
I had a problem talking with you about it earlier is because literally I had it 10 seconds before we went on air and it was amazing. Literally amazing. I couldn't speak. That's how good it was.
Wow.
It was amazing. And the freshly squeezed orange juice.
That's a nice touch.
Nice touch.
Very nice touch.
Very nice touch. Thank you, West Egg Cafe, for that.
Thank you very, very much. Thanks, Jasmine. Also partaking a little bit is our guest here in the Allstate Showcase studio, State Senator Kwame Raoul. Senator Raoul has been in office since 2004, an attorney from, and also went to DePaul, like our previous guest, as law professor, and former Assistant Cook County prosecutor, and lives in Hyde Park. Senator, thank you for getting up and joining me this morning in studio.
Thanks for having me, Rick, and thanks for breakfast.
You're very welcome. We're figuring this might lure more in-studio guests on an early Sunday morning, but we talked about a week ago, I think it was, about the bill that passed the legislature, which reinstates a law against eavesdropping. And the court had struck down the previous law. We basically had no regulations at all. Governor Quinn has not acted on this bill as of yet. But there's a lot of disturbing things in social media on this thing. About one headline that was predominant, I think, was Illinois just made it a felony for its citizens to record the police and the media is silent.
Yeah, Rick, it's important to know the history of the eavesdropping law. Part of that misinformation, based on that statement you just read, Illinois just made it a felony to record police. That had been the state of the law for some 50 years that we had an eavesdropping law, and it's something I was unhappy with. And in fact, Representative Nekritz, who sponsored the eavesdropping bill with me, had introduced a bill several years ago to change that to allow for citizens to record police in the public, as they could do in most states.
Anything else, right.
And so the ACLU sued to enjoin the Cook County State's Attorney's Office from charging anybody,
which had happened
exactly, and so the federal court ruled in the ACLU's favor. Subsequently, the Illinois Supreme Court struck down this past March the eavesdropping law as overly overly broad. And so we took to right away, beginning to negotiate in a bicameral, bipartisan fashion, how to create a fix to the eavesdropping law. And the fix we created was to add language with regards to surreptitiousness, secret recording, and to acknowledge what both the ACLU v. Alvarez and Milongo decision talked about with regards to reasonable expectation of privacy. So much of the language in the bill is similar to the previous law, but we added those two things that in the privacy language kind of mirrors a similar or same as the federal eavesdropping mm-hmm. act and the eavesdropping act in most states, where recording police is
in the performance of their duties.
Right. And so court decisions have long recognized that police don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy when performing their duties in the public.
So that if there is a traffic stop, you're allowed to video the traffic stop.
Correct.
And
audio.
And audio, of course. And, of course, you know, this coming at a time, too, where we're talking more about police wearing, you know, body cameras and things like that, where, you know, we're trying to basically have a record that's
right.
a public record going on here.
Yeah. Now, with regards to body cams, one of the things that we're continuing to talk about is what is going to be the protocol that we may set on a statewide basis with regards to the use of body cams so that you can't just have officers turning on and off body cams whenever they want. But at the same time, you know, officers, you know, who may go use a bathroom or something, they don't have to have their body cam on when
I would not want a FOIA request for that, no. But so reasonable expectation of privacy, what does that mean?
Well, the term reasonableness is used throughout the law. There's no, real finite definition. And some have suggested, well, we should have listed, you know, exactly when you can and can't record. It's impossible to enumerate every hypothetical with regards to recording. So, reasonableness is a term used in law widely, so you can't finitely define it. But with regards to recording police, it has been defined in common law, and the bill refers to that.
And I think that's the part that's missing in a lot of this criticism is, in fact, there is recognized established law. There is recognized established language in a number of instances. Reinstating some of the language of the previous law in some instances, right. where there are definitions for these things.
Yeah, and the other thing that was spread is that, oh, well, we created a disparity with regards to the felony charge for if you record police versus the charge if you record a regular citizen illegally. And we actually reduced the disparity. So it used to be a Class 1 felony to record police as opposed to a Class 4 felony to record regular citizens. We reduced that charge for recording police to a Class 3 felony. And we did money.
Here again, that's surreptitious recording.
Right, right. That's the actual eavesdropping
right.
On police. And you have to understand the instances where it would be a violation to record police. Let's say, you know, police are on the phone at police headquarters and you tap the phone while they're speaking to a complaining witness who wants to be anonymous, or while they're speaking to another officer and discussing sensitive facts about an undercover investigation. We wouldn't want citizens to be able to tap into those conversations. And it's a bit more sensitive than eavesdropping on just
regular,
you
yes.
or I.
Right, right, yes. I would not have much valuable information to provide anybody. There was one bit of controversy, though, and that was the issue of the police with the permission of a state's attorney to record conversations that
yeah.
are, I mean, certainly there are heightened circumstances, issues like kidnapping or whatever. But getting a state's attorney's approval, not a judge's approval.
Yeah. So in Most states, with regards to the eavesdropping, there's one party consent, and so the police could do this in most states. Illinois has long recognized a more heightened protection of privacy. In fact, our Constitution recognizes that. We engaged since the eavesdropping law was stricken altogether.
Right. Left us unregulated.
Right. So it was a wild, wild west of eavesdropping. So given that, coming up with a new law came about by way of negotiation. And one of the parties that was negotiating was the law enforcement community. And so they looked at it as an opportunity to expand their one party consent eavesdropping.
Sure.
Powers, and they wanted to do it a lot more broadly than what we negotiated. So we isolated and agreed to certain serious offenses, murder, I think criminal sexual assault, kidnapping.
Human trafficking,
things of that nature. And we required them to keep a record of
when they sought that approval,
right.
or when they utilize as well as utilizing
exactly, and then there's also, you know, this is only something you can't just go to the state's attorney and have like a right to do it for a week or two. It's a 24-hour limit.
Very limited situations, limited circumstances,
right, exigent kind of circumstances.
State Senator Kwame Raoul is joining me here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I don't want to cut in on that.
Those are beautiful voices.
Yes, that's the University of Illinois Ripcord's a cappella choir doing our holiday music this morning. State Senator Kwame Raoul is joining me here in studio. One last thing on the eavesdropping proposed law. The governor hasn't acted on it yet. You mentioned that some people were criticizing the legislature for acting in haste on this.
Yeah, it is indicated we did this at the last minute at a veto session, when in fact we started dealing with this as soon as the Supreme Court ruled, and we went through months of negotiation. We had public hearings in Springfield. We as a Senate had actually passed a bill substantially similar to the bill that we finally passed in both chambers back in May. And so the public at large had all summer and the fall to look at that. We had another joint hearing in the fall to talk about body cams, but we also touched upon the eavesdropping legislation at large. So the notion that we did this kind of secretly is nonsense.
You mean you can't believe everything you read on the internet? It's amazing. It's amazing.
Certainly not.
Senator, I also wanted to have you in and talk about something that I think is topical as well, is with the passing of Judy Bartopinka as the state comptroller, and now we have Jerry Sturmer has been named by Governor Quinn to be almost like an interim comptroller until the inauguration day on January 12th. You have been sponsor of and plan to sponsor again a proposed state constitutional amendment that would merge the offices of comptroller and treasurer, certainly something that Topinka, who had held both offices previously, was very supportive of. Some people are even dubbing it the Topinka Amendment. It passed the Senate before.
Yes, it passed unanimously. Judy had, she sat beside me as I presented the resolution. I believe Matt Murphy was my
co-sponsor
on the bill, so it was bipartisan. I think the unfortunate death of Judy sheds a different light on it, a more public light on it. More people are talking about it. So perhaps this time around, it may have a different.
I mean, it never got a vote in the House.
No,
it never got out of rules in the House. Mm-hmm. I think, as I recall, and you know that it just seems. I mean, I don't want to go into the long history of why do we have a treasurer and why do we have a comptroller. If you really want to know, Google the name Orville Hodge.
Right.
Okay, he was the elected auditor of the state of Illinois at that time, who basically built the state, and because he was the auditor, he could cover it up.
Right.
So that's why there was this kind of the two offices as a quote checks and balances thing. But now we have an auditor general. That's a legislative appointed auditor general. It's independent of the executive offices, even though it is an executive office. And the work of these two offices is largely ministerial.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't make sense for us to have two offices. You know, the only argument you can put forth to have the two offices, you just give somebody else
another chance to run for
statewide office. And I don't think that's a good reason to maintain both offices. I think now's the time. I think the other topic that's being discussed is whether or not we should have a special election.
That's where I was just going to go to.
And I do favor that. I don't like the fact that we always do these things kind of in a reactionary mode. I think that if we're going to have this discussion about special election for comptroller, we ought to have it with regards to treasurer, secretary of state, attorney general as well. Obviously, for a governor, we have somebody who steps in.
Right.
If the governor is removed or passes away. So.
And, of course, we don't fill the lieutenant governor once that happens as a vacancy. Some people have. You know, we've already seen from the Republican leaders of the legislature their view that this would have to be done through a constitutional amendment, not through legislation. Even though, you know, you have that caveat in the Constitution that does say as provided or as provided by law.
Right. It says that, and it also says that, you know, until. Elected and qualified
to serve, right?
And it nothing explicitly restricts the legislature's ability to set special elections to set elections, right?
So in looking at this topic, do you pass or do you look at passing a bill that would just kind of become almost a generic piece of legislation to apply to other statewide elected offices?
I think that's what makes sense. I don't think we should wait till somebody dies in office and in treasurer or God forbid, you know,
right.
or any of the other offices. You know, given that the light has been shed on this, let's be proactive with regards to the other offices instead of saying, well, we're just dealing with the comptroller's office.
Right, for the year 2016.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, a lot of folks who are saying, well, you know, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this, are the same folks who were saying, well, you should do this when the U.S. Senate seat was vacated by the president.
Right, and the whole issue of Blagojevich and the scandal that followed there.
Right. See, if it was right then, it's right now.
Fair enough. State Senator Kwame Raoul, thank you very much for joining me here this morning on the Sunday Spin. I hope you enjoyed your breakfast.
It was wonderful. Thank you.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Well, that's all we have time for on today's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guest, my Tribune colleague, David Kidwell, and you really should read his report on red light cameras in today's Chicago Tribune. It's just fascinating. I also want to thank DePaul University Law Professor Alberto Cole and State Senator Kwame Raoul, and have to give a thank you, too, to the West Egg Cafe. Appreciate the breakfast.
How many plugs do you have to get for free breakfast?
What?
Fascinating political analysis and begging for food.
Well, you know, you can't talk about politics on an empty stomach, even though it can turn your stomach sometimes.
I guess not.
I mean, I you know, what's wrong with breakfast on Sunday?
For free mentions.
Wow.
Thank you, Dean.